We have with us today a person who embodies the fundamental reasons for the existence of the United Jewish Appeal. She is Mrs. Alla Ruzinek. Since last November, a citizen of the State of Israel, and before that, a Jew in the Soviet Union. And I want to tell you a little bit about what it meant to her being a Jew in the Soviet Union. She'll tell you more. She was born in Moscow 21 years ago. She has known and has fought anti-Semitism during much of her short life. She started by fighting for her right to attend an English high school. After passing the entrance exams with brilliant marks, and she ended up by taking on publicly the whole system in which the Soviet Union tries to expunge Jewishness from the minds and the hearts of the Russian Jews. She was among the Russian Jews who bravely spoke out and signed their names to the written protests and appeals which have made the plight of the Russian Jewry an issue throughout the world. Her growing awareness of her Jewish background and her increasing struggle to be permitted to go to Israel, where she could live as a Jewess, has meant that Mrs. Ruzinek was jeered, hounded, until she had to give up a job. It meant living on what her sister could give her, or on whatever parcels came from abroad. It meant, finally, making the most crucial decision in her life. She had to decide whether she would leave her husband 12 days after her marriage on the chance that his turn to immigrate would soon come, or perhaps give up forever her opportunity to go to Israel in freedom. Mrs. Ruzinek is now living with an aunt in Jerusalem, and she's studying at the Hebrew University. She is here with us today under the auspices of the American Jewish Conferences on Soviet Jewry. And it is a privilege and a pleasure to introduce her all to you. She's new amongst us. Let us give her a big hand.
I'm very happy to speak to you today on behalf of my friends, of my brothers, of my family, of my husband. I'm happy, and we were always happy to know that there are some people who are thinking about us and who are able and are eager to help us. We were born in the Soviet Union, the country that doesn't want Jews to remember anything about their culture, about their religion, about their history. But they don't want us to forget that we're Jews, that we're inferior to Russian people. So we're living in the atmosphere of anti-Semitism. We want to be loyal. We're taught communism. We don't know anything else. And when we're children, we believe. And we want to be useful. It is natural. But we are unwanted. We're second-class citizens. And we're disappointed and in life. In our studies, in our work. We don't want to leave. But we have no way out of this situation because we even don't know when we are children, about the state of Israel. Never before the year of 67, before Six Day War, they never mentioned in their newspapers that Israel was a Jewish state. And I'm sorry to say that until the age of 18, I never knew that Israel is a Jewish state. And the same happens to all young people. But now we know it. The Six Day War helped us. They had to mention this fact because they had to mention the Arab-Jewish conflict. And this was a salvation to us. Because we understood that we have home. We have our own people to live together with them and to live for them. And we didn't fail to understand that we must go there. We must struggle for immigration. But this is not easy. They don't want mass immigration from the Soviet Union. For many reasons, they don't want to lose Jews. They don't want to let them out. So we have to struggle. And this struggle took place already for many years. And the younger generation that can't speak Yiddish, they don't know it. They don't know anything about Jewish history, culture, literature, religion. They are the most active part in this struggle because they don't want to live in a strange country. They were born there, really, and they lived all their short life in among these strangers, but now they don't want. We study Hebrew. Hebrew is forbidden in the Soviet Union, and we study it illegally. We have some Hebrew textbooks, and we get together in small groups and help each other to study Hebrew. We try to find some old books about Jewish history. They don't publish any books about Jewish history or literature. They want us to forget everything. But we find some books published before the Great October Revolution, and we study history. And now we have our national heroes. We learned about Maccabees, about Bar Kokhba, about Warsaw Ghetto. For the first time in our life, when we're already grown-ups, we learned about our heroes. Really, we don't want to be heroes. We want just to emigrate, but they want us to become heroes. They want us to struggle, and we're ready to struggle. We apply for visas. They refuse us. We write letters to the members of the government. Can you imagine what does it mean to write a collective letter to the members of the government and to smuggle it abroad? This means Zionist conspiracy. We come to the synagogue. We are not religious because we never knew about synagogue before. And now we come to the synagogue because it is the only place in Moscow which has some Jewish meaning. And we come there. Thousands of young people, from 10,000 to 30,000, come to a narrow street to express their Jewishness, to see each other, to sing, to dance. Nobody teaches us Israel songs or Israeli dancing. But we know Korah, and we know some songs because every day we listen to Kol Israel. Kol Israel is source of life for us. And we sing these songs near the synagogue. We see each other, and we say, Mi Ata, Israel, Mi Avicha, Israel, Mi Imecha, Israel, and we go home. And were followed by KGB men to our houses. Then we're called to KGB. They try to threaten us, to frighten us, but once we heard about Israel, and once we felt that we are no more orphans, we are not afraid of them. Then they search our houses. They confiscate Hebrew textbooks, books about Israel, postcards, letters from Israel. This is considered to be anti-Soviet Zionist literature. They confiscated one textbook. We have 10 more textbooks. They take me to prison now. 40 young people, our friends. We have 4,000 more young Jews who will join our movement now. They can't stop it. They will never be able to frighten us. We know that we live in a strange country, and we know that no other country would want to take us. But we don't want to go to any other country. Nobody of these 300,000 Jews who apply for exit visas now wants to go to any other country but Israel. We need Israel, and we feel that Israel needs us. We don't want to be just a burden for Israel. We want to be Israeli citizens, to build Israel, to defend it, to be useful to Israel. This is our hope, this is our dream. I can assure you that Jews in the Soviet Union would never be intimidated or suppressed, and they began their great historical struggle. But you can imagine what does it mean to fight against Russia, against mighty power. That's why we ask for help. We need help. We don't ask for pity. The fighters do not need pity, but they need help. Because they can't struggle with rifles for their right to immigrate. That's why we need help. And I want to express our gratitude to you, that you help us when we are fired from our jobs, when we have nothing to eat, when we have no money to buy clothes. The moment we feel that we have no money, suddenly we receive a parcel from abroad. We don't know who sends it. Thank you very much. This helps us. And thank you very much that you give us money to go to Vienna and to go from Vienna to Israel. We have to pay for visa 900 rubles. This means $1,000, but you can't really imagine. For 900 rubles, we have to work a year. And we sell everything. We, those few Jews who were allowed to go last year, we have to sell everything. And we come to Israel without suitcases, without money, without gold. And we are given flats, we are given the possibility to study and to work. Thank you very much. I'm sure that with the help of idealism of Russian Jews and generosity of American Jews, we will build a wonderful and strong home for Jewish people. Thank you.
to say. Except, O God, can't you see, Rachel Mevakal Banea, isn't it time? Allah has to leave right now. We'll excuse her. She has to get up very early in the morning. Go right ahead, Allah. I can't say anything. There's only one guide must follow and close the meeting. And if there's anything to say, I know he will say it. Rabbi Herbert Friedman.
Somebody always has to get up and follow me, and the chairman says, whoever follows him got a tough act to follow. I can't follow her. This is the first time I have heard the presentation. I don't know her, I haven't got a clue as to who she is. But it's the first time that I've ever heard the presentation made quietly, simply, authentically. I've talked to lots of Russian Jews on the way in Vienna. There's a place to which he referred, which we maintain as a way station. I've talked to lots of Russian Jews in Israel the first few days of their arrival, when they've been overwhelmed with the reception. They feel they've been taken in and embraced. But I haven't spoken to any. I haven't heard anybody speak. Now, she's been in Israel about 100 days. She's so utterly sensational. She was asked to come over here. I don't know how she got to this meeting tonight. Whoever you are, God bless you. Who said it? Oh, okay. And I tell you, I'm just as overwhelmed as you are by this thing. I don't know what her plans are. I don't know where she's going early in the morning, but I'm going to find out. Because this is something which, if she's here in the United States and able to talk and willing to talk and willing to risk it in terms of the people of her family who've been let back home, then I think that we have to expose the leadership of American Jewry to this thing, to the impact of this person. And I saw there were two or three other kids with her. And if they're willing to do it, then I think we'll just bomb it right open, that's all. And we will. I think you were privileged here tonight. I think something sensational and historic happened. I think a fire was lit. In a more mundane way, I think the meeting that began at 5 o'clock was, in its own way, Lahavdale, to distinguish, but I'll still use the same word, a sensation. I've been many years in this business, and I have not seen a meeting like this in the New York City UJA before. I've seen it in other cities, never here. And I take my hat off to Larry and Rick and Ernie and Herb Tenzer and Jimmy Weinberg and Elaine and everybody who organized this thing. Great 2 hours, 3 hours up to now. I think you're on the way. I don't really even raise $150 million this year. I was asked to come here and tell you why $400 million is required. I'm not going to try to make a speech. If you want to stay and we can answer some questions, I'll be glad to do it. I will answer that one question. Why is $400 million required? And that is the answer. Why do you have to try to get $150 million of it? The answer to the question is in two parts. One, the figures, the mathematics of the situation. Why 400? and the other the reason, the need. The mathematics are simple. They derive from the need. We need that much money because we're trying to do two things in 1971. Fight a war and win a peace. Now what are you trying to accomplish? Both war and peace in the same year. It's enormously more expensive than anything you ever tried to do before. There will be a shortfall of $1 billion on both accounts. On the account of the war, when we take into account everything that the Israelis will produce themselves, everything that we will get in the way of loans from the outside world, from private sources, everything that we get from the government of the United States in the form of a loan, which is a known fact, that's $500 million. When you add in everything that you can produce on the revenue side from all sources, and then you take all the expenses that are related to war and peace, and peace means to us the taking in of the 50,000 people for this year, and she's the symbol. And when Rick says that he was talking to Golda, and Golda says she firmly believes that hundreds of thousands will come. And this beautiful child stands up here and says 300,000 have registered for exit visas. So we're not talking mythically. We're not talking wishful thinking. We're beginning to talk reality about Russian Jews. If 20 years ago you said, as Ben-Gurion used to say, I believe the Jews of Russia will come. And Eshkol echoed it, and Shared echoed it. Every prime minister of Israel said it. This was an expression of a millennial Jewish dream. This is the source from which you and I come. Why do we react so emotionally to her? My father came from Vilna. Somebody else's father came from Riga, somebody else's father came from Kovno, somebody else's father came from, you know the names. There's a visceral reaction, there's a family reaction. She's the closest thing there is. So we used to say emotionally, they will come and we will take them in. It was pure emotion. We're getting closer now to the bone, fellows. We're getting closer to the reality. It's not so emotion now. Now it's getting to be more factual. And so then it wells up inside that hope that at last something's coming true. So when we say we want to be able to wage peace this year as well as wage war, what we say is we want to be able to afford to keep the door of the country open. What the hell's the sense of fighting the war if you want to win the war so you can keep the door open for her? 50,000 more or 350,000 more. Okay? All the money that you have coming in on one side, and then all the expenses that you figure on the other side for the war and the peace, leaves you with a shortfall of just about $1 billion. We can't balance it by about $1 billion. And isn't there was a magic figure? Didn't pick $1 billion out of the air. We've got all the documents, which I don't have to bore you now. All the income on one side, and there was more than we thought there would be. We never thought that American loan would be $500 million from Congress. So when we took it all and put it together, we find we're short about $1 billion. We cut up the $1 billion into three possible sources from which we could get it. We'll have to go out and borrow $400 million of it. That's bonds. That's borrowed money. I dare say everybody in this room buys bonds. Well, you're not giving away anything. You're loaning some money to Israel. And if Jews, and by the way, not just Jews, banks, pension funds, insurance companies, lots of fiscal institutions buy those bonds, loan Israel money. If they loaned Israel a couple of $100 million last year, which is just about it, around 150 million in the United States, and I think 20, 30 million outside the United States. Fine. Then Israel's got to double it and find people who will buy $400 million worth of her bonds. And there's a very big push on. And for the first time, the president of Israel is coming to the United States in about a month to launch the 1971 bond sale campaign in the United States, the president of Israel himself. And they're going to have to break their backs, everybody working in the bond organization and all of us who work and believe in Israel, to see if $400 million can be sold. And it's as much our responsibility to see that that gets sold as it is for us to try to bring in the free money. And you've never heard me say that before. But there's one Israel. And it's not a bond Israel, and it's not a UJA Israel, and it's not a Jewish National Fund Israel, and it's not a Istatlut Israel, and it's no... Parts are no good. The whole... I can't tell you, I can't make a prognosis as to whether $400 million in bonds can be sold, but that's the target. The second piece of it is what the Jews and the rest of the world can do in the way of giving money. And that's been assigned out all over the world, and that's a total of $200 million. I'm going down to Mexico next week. We're going to get that thing started. There's a little community of 4,000 families down there. We set a target of $8 million. We're going after $8 million in Mexico City from those 4,000 Jews. They'll raise it. England took $40 million. Canada took $40 million. We're going for $200 million in the rest of the Jewish world, not in the Soviet Union. Certain places we don't have even change. Which leaves the third element. It comes to 400 bonds and 200 in the rest of the world, and you may say 400 for the United States. Free gift dollars. You chain it. Well, if $400 million has got to be raised by the UJA in all the communities of America, and you heard the way Larry explained it today, that in New York you have two campaigns, UJA and Federation. In all the other cities, they're together. It's one campaign, so the Federation in every city needs a little bit of money. And you add up all the federations all over the United States, what they need for Los Angeles and Cleveland and Baltimore, the whole thing, it's quite modest, by the way, it comes to $80-90 million for the whole America. So it isn't really very much. But it means if we want 400 for the UJA, we've got to raise 500 million out there. And all the other local stuff gets taken care of for about 100 million, 90 million, and that'll leave 400 million for Israel. So what should New York's share be? Out of a $500 million gross campaign of the whole United States of America, New York should be about a third. We had terrible arguments in Los Angeles and Boston and other cities where they said New York's got half the Jews in America. New York ought to take half the quota of 250. We fought the thing out. We asked Chicago to take 50 million. We asked Los Angeles to take 50 million. And so we said New York 150, not 250. But I want you to know that 3 months ago there was an awful lot of fighting up on the top. 150 comes out therefore to be your share, and 50 Los Angeles and 50 Chicago, that's half of, in those three big towns, and probably 60-70% of all the Jews of America live in those three towns. And the other half we parceled out among all the other cities in the country. We're running hard, we're running fast. We're all getting up early in the morning and moving on to the next town, like she is. I spoke at a luncheon meeting for women here in New York on Monday. This is Thursday. Between Monday and Thursday, I've been in Chicago, Detroit, and Miami. And we're running, and we're pushing, and we're pushing, and we're running, and we're organizing, and I must say it's going well. It's a lot of money, $150 million. But in this gigantic metropolis, it's not. It's really not. You're better organized than you've ever been. You've got better plans than you've ever had. You've got more motivation than I've ever seen. You've got better leadership at the top in these two men than I've ever seen. You've got everything going for you. And if somebody says to you, why the 400? Why the 150 for New York? The mathematics, I can't change. I gave you the mathematics. And after you explain the mathematics to people, and they say, why the hell is so much money required? Then you've got only two words to answer, war and peace. Tomorrow the ceasefire comes to an end. Tomorrow midnight, 24 or 26 hours from now. The Egyptians have said to the Americans, not to the Israelis. The Egyptians haven't said anything to the Israelis. The Egyptians have said to the United States State Department that they will extend the ceasefire for 30 days. Fine. There'll be no shooting tomorrow midnight, or Shabbat morning, or Sunday morning, or Monday morning. The blessed, precious sound of silence in which no bullets come to take no lives will be something very desirable. We love that silence. I want you to know that there is almost no one in any position of responsible authority in Israel who believes that that will last. Or to put it the other way, the bets are for the resumption of war. Not because anybody wants it on the Israeli side, but because the ceasefire, whether extended 1 month or not, will at some point be broken as the last ceasefire was broken. Nasser announced it. And in March of 69, he broke it, and firing went on for 16 months, March of 69 to August 5th of 70. I don't think the next round, which will break out quite soon, in my judgment, will last 16 months. I think the intensity of fire will be much higher. I think the escalation will be much faster. I think the explosive quality of it will generate more quickly, and I think therefore it'll be over sooner. Because I think they will come to an understanding that they cannot achieve their objectives by force. When they learn that, they'll cool it. We have no objectives. We have no desire to conquer Cairo. There's no place we want to go. The only thing we don't want to do is move back. We don't want to move forward. We'll sit tight. They can pour all the fire in the world on us. They won't force us back. When they learn that,